I wish I had like the Jeopardy music. I'd be like,
yeah. You know, in country music, you're not gonna outdo Hank. So it's like you can't over Hank it. You know, it's like no matter how many times you do it, you might can over drink it, you know, and overthink it. And if a ship comes rolling in, you can sink it. But you in country music, you can't over Hank it. That's just the truth of it, man.
Hey, this is Party Like a Rockstar podcast, and I'm your host, Joel. Today's episode is brought to you by Misha's Kind Foods. They're an LA-based small business making the world's finest non-dairy cheese on the market today. They're lactose-free, paleo, keto, kosher, perev, and 100% vegan. If you like what you see, check out the next video. If you like this video, please subscribe and like by clicking the little round button on the bottom right. To learn more about me or our other guests on the show, go to joelrody.com. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, or TikTok. The handle is Joel Rohde. If you haven't already read my book, Memoir of a Rohde, it's now available through Amazon and paperback, Kindle, or as an audiobook. I hope you enjoy the show.
All right.
Cool. Okay, I'll introduce you guys. We'll get going here.
Yes, sir.
Brian Martin is a Cherokee Indigenous American country artist. His newest album is titled Self-Inflicted Scars. Urge you to check it out. Second guest is David Rosales. His newest release is called Spoonful. It was released in honor of Earth Day and is streaming now. It's funny, actually, because I watched the video, I kind of got high. Spoonful. But it's because it's like the nicest little video. If it was like a dark video, it would have been like Spoonful. You can check it out on YouTube. I am going to add the link here. The video is fucking great. And I urge everybody to check it out. And so my first question is actually, it's a question to you here, David. And you wrote a song called Good to Be Alive. And yeah. I was wondering what the song's about.
Yeah, it's a great question. Thanks for having me on, Joel. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Okay, second question. No. Well, it was right, meant right. to be a joke. It was meant to be a joke because it's good to be right, alive. I don't know. I was gonna ask Brian here. How come you don't write any good to be alive song?
I'm still trying to find that day.
No, actually, if you have a real answer, I'd love to hear it. What do you have, David?
Yeah, no, a big trail runner. And I just got into running. It's weird because you think you know how to run until you start running long distances. And then you realize that you have no idea how to really run. I mean, it's like anything that you get into. You're like, the more you get into it, you're like, oh, I don't know anything about this now. So I got real into it and just like doing these ultra marathons and stuff. And it's a real kind of cool thing and a good community to be a part of. And just being out and about, you know, in the hills here in Southern California and wherever else I am and stuff. And
are you one of those guys that will do like a 100-mile race?
Yeah, I mean, well, an ultra is classified as anything over a marathon distance. So yeah, we go 50K to 100 mile, 120, whatever. You know, I've never gone at that distance. It's definitely something that you build up to. And there's a lot of cats that are older, you know, like, you know, 50s, they're hitting their peak and stuff like that because they have time to train. They also have the, you know, they're not as like, when you're a young cat, you just want to go out and hit it, pound it, just go, you get injured that way. So, you know, like, you just kind of learn the game and how to roll with it. But anyways,
like sparkling water now instead of regular water.
What was that?
You drink like sparkling water now instead of regular water.
Right. Yeah, exactly. older. Yeah.
Man, I did a bit of running. I was awful though. Like bad. The nice thing about running long distances is when you do your mile warm up, you laugh at how easy it is to run a mile because you're used to running so many.
And yeah.
You remember yourself like in junior high school where they'd make you run the mile and you'd be like, this is bullshit.
No, it's definitely one of those weird things is, you know, you can relate to when you tour on the road and you're going like, well, somebody's going like, okay, well, you know, hey, can you come and do this gig? You know, let's say you're based in Los Angeles. They're like, can you come up to Bakersfield and do this gig or something like that? Or San Diego. You're like, yeah, that's quick. You know, I'll just go run down and do it. And other people are like, whoa, like that's like a whole day thing for me or something. You know, they're not distance and is something different to a touring artist as well as, you know, a distance runner, you know? So you're like, oh, I'm going to go out and on an easy 10 miler, you know, and somebody else that doesn't run, they're like, what are you talking about? 10 miles, like quick. That's like, I don't think I'll ever run that, you know? And you're like, yeah. It's like a quick, you know, pace thing for me and stuff. So anyways, I got into this whole jam of running and made me feel good, and decided to write a song about it that other runners and people that go adventuring and hiking in the outdoors could understand as well. And I was like, it's a cool thing. And then it got picked up by Trail Runner magazine, and I have a bunch of, you know, nutsos like me that are around the country that come out and see shows and stuff that are all like, hey man, I totally connected with your song, you know, I use it as my warm-up, or you know, it's just a good jam. And
is there a lot of VWs at your concerts?
Yeah, tons of them. Yeah, man, it's you know, there's a fair amount, but like for example, I got a tour coming up and we're going over to Colorado Springs, and a guy's like, I can't believe you're coming to Colorado Springs. And I'm like, he's like, oh, I found you, you know, love Good to Be Alive. And, you know, so it's definitely connecting with people. And right. I'm really fortunate that kind of got picked up and authentic and genuine. It's not like contrived. It's not. So it's, you know, it comes from a real spot. It's, you know, just waking up every day, getting out the door and feeling good to be alive, you know, just getting out there. So
that's cool. All right, Brian. Yeah. So I did a little bit. I looked it up. I wanted to see on Wikipedia what other American Indian bands or songwriters are. Now there's a few real obvious ones that what was it, Red, you know, they were all Indian. It was part of the name of the whole thing, but there's a couple that were new. So Marty Robbins,
he was
a Native American.
That was my dad's favorite artist.
Oh, neat.
Yeah, I grew up listening to everything he put out, and you know, that was the big thing, is like, there's not very many, but at the same time, like, you know, I'm just as American as I am Native American. So you know, it's kind of one of those things where I really take a lot of pride in it, but at the same time, I take a lot of pride in my mama's side of the family too. So it's not no double-edged sword there for me.
How did your parents meet? Was your dad from a reservation or no?
Oh, my dad's mama is almost full-blooded Native American, and my dad's dad was adopted, and they were from San Antonio, Texas. And,
okay.
They migrated from San Antonio area out to East Texas, and then I was the only one born in Louisiana. So I was born in Louisiana, and my mama on her side of the family, it's a lot of Irish, and so it's like a little bit of Irish and Cherokee, a little bit of everything mixed together. And
you sound like an angry motherfucker then.
We'll be good.
Oh, you cut out. What did you say?
I said, just keep me away from whiskey. We'll be good.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it's a deal.
You know, it's like, I really just enjoy, you know, writing stuff that really means a lot to me. And, like I said, there's a lot of drug use and stuff in my family when I was growing up. And I kind of thought that for a long time that I was going to be subject to that for the rest of my life. And I use songs as a way of healing and getting through all that and seeing all that happen in my life. And I use it as a tool of healing and finding peace in it, you know. So it's like, that's the biggest thing about it. And it's just, you got to keep pushing through. I wish I could run a mile. I mean, I've heard him talking about running 10 miles, 100 miles. I'm like, man, I'm just trying to work on my first 100 yards.
Well, I mean, you're kind of a whirlwind right now. You're getting really popular really quick, which is a great thing, man. It's a good thing. I actually wrote to some roadie dudes, a stagehand guy, because he was a mutual friend on Facebook. It's my little cheat, you know. I'm like, tell me some shit on this guy.
Yeah.
And he's like, I ain't got no shit. He's like, I love that fucking dude. So it's a little hats off, you know. It's kind of good stuff. It's nice to hear. So were you writing poetry as kids, or did you guys write straight to the guitar when you were little, or how did you guys both get started? Because you know, it's interesting about the two of you is though you're a bit different genres, definitely different vocal styles for sure. You're both singer-songwriters, and in my world, that's my favorite kind of music. So what was it that got you guys thinking that you should mix words around and try and make them pretty?
I'll let you go first.
Yeah, you go.
Okay, all right. Well, my deal was, like I said, I kind of learned at an early age that, you know, I could string a couple words together and make them rhyme, and you know, it was one of those things where, like I said, even as a kid, I didn't realize it until I was like 7, 8 years old, but I started battling with a little bit of, you know, anxiety and depression and all that stuff. And so I would write poetry to kind of help me heal even at that early age. And my mama was dragging me around singing festivals and stuff when I was a kid. I actually burned out on singing by the time I was 13. And then I started focusing on writing. And because my mama used to play on the Louisiana Hayride with Farron Young and David Houston and all those guys. And
neat.
I burned out on the singing at 13, and I said, I'm going to focus on writing. And really and truly, I never thought I'd actually, me being an artist, would ever outgrow that part of me. But, you know, it is what it is. I'm thankful for all of it.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Mine's a little bit, I guess, you know, yeah, you figure out words work a certain way with each other. But, you know, I'm the youngest of 10 kids. So I was like pretty influenced by everything that my brothers and sisters were listening to. So
were your parents like really religious?
Well, I come from a mixed family. It was Catholic, you know, but it's a mixed family. So, you know, I had half brothers and sisters and stuff like that. But, you know, so I was just, you know, taking whatever influences, you know. So I was watching a ton of MTV before everybody else was, on my block. You know, I'd sneak into my brother's room, grab his white, you know, Yamaha bass, and pretend I was playing in front of Buffalo Stadium too, like, you know, Duff was, you know. You know, grab my sister's hairbrush and stuff. So then when I asked for a guitar, when I was like about 10 or 11 probably, it just looked cool. Everything that, you know, was Slash looked cool. Like, you know, James Hetfield looked cool to me, you know, it was all that. It was very hard rock, very rock and roll for me. And, you know, so, I got a guitar from my grandfather who lived in North Dakota, he got it at a barn. And sent it out to California. I started playing on it right away. Didn't even know what I was doing, but knew I was started coming up with songs like right away.
You still have the guitar?
Yeah, I still have the guitar. Yeah, I'm in my like writing shed thing here, you know? So it's okay. it's you got a lot of like, my wife's like, oh, you're going to get another guitar or something like that. And it's like, well, you know, yeah, they're all little memories. And, you know, even if they're a shit guitar or something like that, they got a ton attached to them. Yeah. But I started writing and didn't even really know what I was doing, but started writing those songs at like 11. But I don't remember really when, you know, yeah, I would be writing poetry and I'd also be drawing skulls with like nooses and stuff like that, because I was turned on by like heavy metal and thrash and all that stuff. Everything, there used to be those little magazines, right, with like the t-shirts and stuff. And I would just look at like Deicide and, you know, Megadeth was my first concert that I ever went to and stuff. So I come from that kind of whole world. And, you know, and then punk came in later. And then, you know, when you're skateboarding and as a teenager and stuff. And so we had bands and I was always kind of like one of the principal main songwriters of these bands and stuff. And
what was your first band's name?
First band was called Poe, P-O-E.
Okay. And then we had
another band called Poe at that time. So this was like 90s.
I remember, you know? The other band. Yeah.
And we were all turned on by like Edgar Allan Poe and stuff. The Raven, we had a song, The Raven, where we put all those lyrics and then we just came up with like a punk kind of thing. And I mean, we were jumping off, you know, pools, you know, jumping off roofs into pools, skateboarding, just, you know, playing at like, you know, dances and stuff. I remember the first gig we played was we got hired to play a party. And
oh, your camera turned off, Dave.
Yeah. Oh, sorry about that.
It's a beautiful mug.
First thing we got, you know, we were playing at, we got and knew like three songs. We had like two of our own and we knew Ruby Soho by Rancid. And so we just fucking played that like on repeat like 12 times. It was like one more time, you know. it was it's been a long journey. And I was in a hard rock band for a lot of years and then kind of went to the singer songwriter thing when I turned 30 and I had a little baby girl on the way. And a band kind of dissolved. And, you know, there comes a time in a guy's life or just any musician's life where you kind of reach those crossroads. And the guys had one foot in, one foot out. And I was like, man, I got to do this. This is what I want to do. And so I'd written this album called Smile, which was completely different from the album that I had just come out with my band called Songs in the Key of Dead. So it was like two different things. I went about like, you know, it was a very Stone Temple Pilots, Guns N' Roses, that family tree of band. You know, and writing like that, you know, darker kind of stuff. And into writing these songs and feelings that I just came like, wow, I'm having a baby. I'm started writing about love, didn't feel cheesy. You know, and then once the band dissolved, I was like, well, I still want to play music. So
yeah, I think you could do it because you're kind of like, dude, it's about my daughter, man. She's on the way, yeah. Motherfucker.
Fuck you. You know. Yeah, you know? And no, man, it's a crazy thing. You know, chemically you change as a dad. Like you just, your vibe, your the way you think, what priorities are. And you know, it's all, I've always followed this, like whatever I'm feeling kind of mentality. And it just felt right at the time. And so I started following this other Americana kind of path, which was just stripped down. And I didn't grow up listening to a ton of country or anything like that, or any folk really. You know, my dad was from Texas, you know, we go back to like the Alamo days. You know, my family came from the King of Spain, sent over in Veracruz, Mexico, came up from there. We also have some Native American, you know, mixed in and stuff. And, you know, my dad came out for the Marine Corps in Korean War and to Camp Pendleton in San Diego. And my mom came from North Dakota. So they were both first generation California and Los Angeles. And anyways, I'm going here and there. Yeah, and everywhere.
Going deep.
We're getting to know the man behind the songs, man. That's what it's all. Yeah. You got a story, and that's what makes us storytellers, man. We lived a life. What makes the songs what they are. We've lived life, man. That's the way it works.
I think that's a great point you bring up. Is it's in a band, you're kind of creating your story. You know, you got your four buddies, you know, five buddies. It's all for one for all. And now, it's a little less personal. I feel like sometimes, and being a singer songwriter, you write about the shit that you go through, and you can't really fake it. You know, it's all pretty authentic if you're going to sing about it. Cause you're the one singing about it. It's your name up on the billboard. It's your thing. You know, you can't really,
That's the one thing, like I've always said this, and this is something I've always believed in. I've always wrote really and truly. I always wrote for myself to kind of, like I said, heal and go through things and process. I've always been somebody, like I really can't go and talk to somebody about my problems, but I can talk to a guitar. You know what I mean? Like my guitar has always kind of been my therapy session. So I go in and I'll talk to this guitar, and I may not even know that I need that song until a year later, and that song hits me, and it's like, oh man, I needed to hear that today or something, you know? And when you get to relate to other people by doing the same thing, and you hear their stories about how they're going through the same thing, and that song helped them change their life. It's like, that's what I did it for me, but I helped somebody else. So it's like, I've always said, I only write what I live, and I won't write nothing I ain't lived unless I'm ready to live through it. That's just what it's like. I really believe if you ain't lived it and you're writing it, you better buckle up and get ready, because you're probably going to go through it. And I've already been through enough. I'll just write about what I live.
That song it's you did. So you did a song about Hank Williams. Did you write that one?
Yeah. Over Hank.
Yeah. So is it a little intimidating to stick a guy's name like Hank Williams in your song and hope that everybody kind of like digs it? Cause
it is. It's tough because, like I said, it's one of those things where you want to pay homage at the same time, but it's like this, the way I've always looked at it is, you know, everybody uses that name in songs, but you know, in country music, you're not gonna outdo Hank. So it's like you can't over Hank it. You know, it's like no matter how many times you do it, you might can overdrink it, you know, and overthink it. And if a ship comes rolling in, you can sink it. But you in country music, you can't over Hank it. That's just the truth of it, man. And I think that a lot of people use that name as kind of like a what do you call it? Like a cliche thing. But for me, it was in intentions of going, hey, you know, I've listened to this all my life. No matter what I do, I'm not gonna be able to, you know, overhang a damn song, you know. So that's what my intentions were on that song, and that was kind of like the fun song on the album. The rest of them go a little bit deeper, so it's you know. But that's the one I had a good time with Colt Ford. He jumped on there. I think it's the first time I've ever had a Colt jump on anything with mine, and that's the first time I ever branched over into a different genre too. So like to have him come on there and do what he does best, you know, jump on there and lay down a verse and get people moving. I like that. You know, he's really energetic. He's took me in as a little brother underneath my wing, and I really appreciate everything they're doing with me over there.
That's cool. I'm going to pick on you a bit, possibly. I don't know. So one of the bones I love bringing up is the crazy gigs you've had, you know, places you've played out where you're thinking, boy, my mom could see me now, you know, but I think I'm right here. Did you try out for American Idol?
When was this? Back in 2010, I believe. 2010, when I was like 19, 20 years old, I did. I did try out. I mean, at that stage in my life, life hadn't hit me real hard yet. So I was still trying to do the singing thing. So it's like, as you go on with life and you start finding depth in it. And like he was talking about having babies, and I started realizing real fast that, you know, there was a lot more things important to me than going on a reality TV show. But I'll be honest with you, they didn't even give me 10 seconds of time. They said I wasn't worth shit.
What did you sing?
I think I, man, to be honest with you, like you threw me in this spot, but I sang Burn Guys and Chisel and Stone. And I mean, you got to think about it. At that time, nobody else was auditioning with a Vern Gosden song. But, you know, my daddy was a big Vern fan, and he always used to pick on me all the time. But he's like, man, you're pretty good, but you ain't no Vern Gosden. You know? And I kind of always took that to heart. But at the same time, I was like, you're right. I'm not Vern. I'm Brian Martin. Like, I got to be me, and I got to do what I do. And I've never set out to be the best vocalist because I really believe that if you really have the emotions in a song, the vocals do the rest. You know, it's like your vocals, you don't have to out-sing Van Halen or none of those guys. If you got the right emotions and the right story in your song, then it kind of tells its own story itself. You know?
Yeah. Do you have any gigs that stand out, David, where you were playing and you're kind of like, why is there a truck of buffaloes in front here or whatever?
You know, there's just
I don't even know what the hell that meant, by the way. I don't know. Truck of buffalo. I don't know.
But I'm not even gonna draw attention to it. I mean, there's little things along the way, but it's sometimes hard to kind of go like take things in, you know, and just kind of go like, oh man, I'm here. Like, this is, you know, on a cool level, like, hey, like I've gotten to this point. You know, like, this is a great gig to have. You're more like, okay, what's the next thing? What's the next thing? You know, you're trying to move up this ladder or whatever, you know. But, you know, just times where you're, you know, you're playing. I was stuck in an elevator with Joe Perry one time going down to the House of Blues, you know, and just talking with Joe about, you know, I think that their bus had just ran into a deer. And so we started talking. My drummer was with me, and so he was a big hunter. And so we were talking about hunting. And I'm like, I can't believe I'm fucking sitting here or in an elevator talking with Joe fucking Perry about hunting and like a deer and a thing. And I'm like, this is just wild. And you know, there's just times where you're just like, there's gigs where you're like, what the fuck am I doing here? This is not worth it. You know, this is not, there's nobody here. I'm out in the, you know, middle of fucking nowhere. And there are times where you're just like, you roll in, you got your whole production, and you know, you got guys, because it's a union job, they won't let you touch your gear whatsoever. You feel like a fucking rock star. And you're like, this is all right, this is good stuff. You know, like, I'm a big sports guy, right? So sports have always been there for me, as well as music. Like, they've always just been there, and they've always been my outlets. And my dad was a big you know, sports guy and stuff. And so when I left, I went to college. I went, you know, came out with a business degree, worked at Sony Pictures, you know, and took my boss's expense report to accounting one time. And, you know, I was a young kid and in a really good position up in LA, and, you know, much better than what my age probably, you know, said I should be in. But, took boss's expense report. Two guys were talking, probably about our age now, you know, and they were just saying, oh, I hate the drive in, you know, I was soccer, you know, on the weekend, this thing and that and the other, you know, just hating their life, you know, just kind of cooler talk. And I said, that's what I don't want. I don't want to be there. And so I left that corporate job. And then I had to explain to my dad, you know, who had, you know, like, you're climbing this corporate ladder, you're going to be a, you know, a studio executive one day, you know, you play music on the side, you do this and that and the other thing.
So I got 9 other kids that will help pay for you then. You know,
I mean, it's wild. By the time it got to me, they were like, okay, just do what you want to do. But, you know, there was a pride thing. Like, my dad was like, you know, like, he came from nothing. He used to pick cotton in the cotton fields, watermelons, all that stuff down in Texas. And so he came from a dirt floor. Spanish was his first language. So he made something of his life. He was a principal in LA Unified School District. You know, and, you know, supported us and did that. But sports was always like the common ground, you know, like, I could curse on the ball field. You know, my dad didn't like give me a belt or anything like that. But if I did it at home, he'd definitely, you know, tan my hide. But I explained it to him. I said, hey, Dad, you know, I'm going to be playing the minor leagues, basically. But what ball player isn't going to go for their shot, you know, in the majors? And I want to get up, you know, I'm be touring around and, you know, squalor and, you know, kind of touring around. And it's going to look like road trips, you know, like with your buddies and stuff. But
did you get a scholarship to college?
What's that?
Did you get a college scholarship?
No. I'm talking about after college. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So basically I'm equating it to being a, you know, a ball player, you know, going like, hey, Dad, you know, I'm going to be touring around with my rock and roll band and in a van, you know, basically like a bus touring around to these podunk cities, you know, with my minor league ball club. And he's like, okay, I kind of get it. And he's like, and he started building into the idea of it more, you know, of that whole idea of like, okay, yeah, but what ball player wouldn't keep playing ball? So this is what my son wants to do, play music. Okay, I get it, you know. And he's, you know, he passed a couple of years ago, and he got to see me do some real cool things and see his, you know, my name up on the big lights, and, you know, just always proud of me and stuff. And he definitely, you know, grew into that, like, okay, this is exactly what my son should be doing, you know. And yeah, man, it's a cool example. Yeah, I guess to answer your question roundabout way, yeah, man, there's times where there's, you know, goats and buffalo in the audience, you know, and there's times where there's, you know, thousands of people and you're stoked. And but they're the ups and downs of touring that, you know, and that all the roadies know. And it's just, it's a fucking, it gets addicting, and you don't want to do it when you come home. You're like, never going on a fucking road trip again or tour. And you're like, but then you're like jonesing to get back out there, because you're like, oh, it's the adventure of it. You know, the whole thing of it, you bring in a little dough that feels good. You know,
you imagine like the back Willie Nelsons or the BB Kings, where they've literally been on the road forever, like since the dawn of time.
Well, and especially the blues guys, you know, and in environments that were inhospitable, you know, in the South, you know, dealing with all that shit, you know.
Mm-hmm. And Charlie Patton was another one here. He was actually Cherokee.
Oh, yeah. Really?
Yeah.
I mean, literally dealing with all that stuff, you know, the South is a different thing too, because, you know, my dad grew up in the 50s and he was dark skinned, won Texas State Championship in high school, but wasn't allowed to drink from the same water fountain and go to the same restaurants that his football team was, even though he was one of the star football players. So it was like one of those things where, you know,
not that long ago, huh? It's crazy.
Not that long ago. And just crazy, because you think it's only, you know, for the black kids or something like that. And you know, my dad and another guy on his football team, the black kid, and so the Mexican kid, Mexicans were almost treated worse, you know, in Texas.
It's pretty rough, man. That's the one thing I can contest to that. There was a lot of people that actually picked on me in school, because they were like, you know, they thought I was, you know, thought I was Mexican. I always just said, well, hey, if I am, I am, you know. It's like San Antonio, there ain't no telling what I am. I'm a little bit of everything, but now my grandma.
Absolutely. But it's crazy. It's wild to think about that. When you think about Jackie Robinson playing baseball and just the 50s, you're like, man,
pressure on your shoulders.
Oof. That wasn't long ago, you know. No. That's a wild about. And just being a musician at those times, you know, and what they were trying to deal with, you know, yeah, we're dealing with, you know, just trying to get to the next city or doing whatever and life on the road that, you know, but they were dealing with discrimination, injustice, all that kind of shit.
I got a random one in Spoonful. Is that you dancing with the paper mache hat on?
So everybody thinks that. They're like, oh, did you keep that big old spoon, that head?
Oh, he's a really good dancer. He's cutting a rug.
Oh, no. That girl was like 5'2", and they're both girls, and they're dancers. They're, you know, I had a friend that's my buddy who I said, I don't know what this, I usually have a good idea about what a video should be. And so this guy that I've been working with for a long time, my buddy Zach, I said, you know what, just take this and run with it. He's like, I kind of want to do something like based on Forky and kind of Pixar thing, but I want to make it trippy, you know? And I'm like, go with it. I'm like, run with it. And so we just kind of talked about some ideas and stuff. And I just said, you know, I want it to be like digestible enough for a little kid, but I also wanted it to be, you know, how like in Disney and Pixar and stuff, there's a little bit of like innuendo that kind of only adults will get and stuff. And I was like, yeah, let's do something like that, so that there's like an acid tab that the spoon's tripping out on and stuff in the video. And, but, you know, it's nice enough. But yeah, no, that's not me. But everybody asked if I kept that head. The head is like a big paper mache thing, right? And so the filmographer who did it, he actually kept it, took some of the hair off, and it's sitting in Long Beach, California, in his apartment window, looking down on the street. And he's like, "Yeah, man." Everybody trips out when they look at that thing. It's like, "Ah, what is that thing?"
I got him right here, actually, but I got my that's my paper mache guy. Dude.
Man,
I keep him in the bedroom, but my girlfriend made me take him out of the bedroom.
Like, hey, we're down to business and pay things out here.
What'd you say, Brian?
More action if you take the paper mache guy out of the bedroom.
That's weird. It wasn't into it.
That's what I yeah. But anyways, yeah.
So when I first started putting together this podcast, we've been talking about kids for briefly, but my buddies mostly have kids now. And one of my friend's daughters said that I should ask every guest when they first felt famous. So I ask each of you guys, when did you first feel famous? Now, if fame is not a road that you choose to pursue in answering your question, totally cool. The question then would be, when was there a moment in your career as a catalyst that really evolved and changed things up that made you feel good about yourself or set you on the right way? Or where's a kernel of time in your life that you would share?
Man, aren't we, Joel?
What do you say?
We're going deep, aren't we?
Dude, yeah, little kids, man, they're smart. My questions are actually my next one here. It was Brian was Texas County Songwriter of the Year. And if you look up the video on YouTube where they did an interview with you, they spelled songwriter wrong.
Oh, I know.
The thing.
I know.
Those are my deep questions. That's me getting into it.
That's the one thing. Like I won a Country Songwriter of the Year in Texas in 2019. But to be honest with you, man, I really, like I said, I still struggle with that every day. Like some people tell me, you know, just because of numbers or this, that, and the other, they try to put a label on me. And it's like, to me, you know, I've always been about the song. I've always been about keeping it real and being who I am. So it's like, I still ain't ever going to change that. And the one thing that, the only time I actually felt that kernel of time you said was when I wrote a song and my daddy, it led my dad to the Lord, and it changed his life. And I wrote that back when I was like 21, 22 years old. I was on a tractor, Bush Hog, 95 acres, with a 5-foot Bush Hog, and it was 110 degrees, no roof, no air conditioner. And I was just working out there, and I wrote this song for my dad. And my dad had struggled with being an alcoholic for most of my life, and it was one of those times where when I was able to reach him and break through to him with a song, enough for him to change his life. I told myself in that moment that, you know, if I can reach him, I may be able to reach some more people, you know, and that's what led me to where I am today, you know, and that's not fame, but to me, that's a reach. And, it, you know, reaching one person to me has always meant more to me than anything. And if I've done that, then whenever my time's done, then I did what I was supposed to do.
That's great, man.
Yeah,
man. That's a cool moment. I don't trump that, Dave. You should have gone first, David.
Yeah, I think I could try. You know, it's everybody's story's truth and stuff, so it's right for them. And you know, so like, I guess when you feel moments where you feel like you've made it or become famous or something like this, I don't know, man. It's like I'm still not, you know. So it's like you're still. You know, you're still working it, you know, you're still trying to do your thing.
Paper mache head is like more popular than you.
No, man, it's, you know, you might be famous to, you know, some people that you don't even know, man. So it's like, I don't know. What does that question even mean?
It's interesting because it's coming from a little kid. So when you were a little kid, Hank Williams, Marty Robbins, they're famous, let's say, you know, and as you grow older, maybe you'd be more interested in meeting Nancy Griffith than Marty Robbins. It just changes up your life. So you know, fame is totally different.
Yeah, I think probably the time that keeps you going is just that I think being on stage is like when you feel like, wow, I'm doing something. People are looking. People are vibing off this. They're cheering. This is like scoring a touchdown for 40 minutes here. You know, this is that same feeling. It gets a high, man. It's a natural high. And you're always chasing that, And it's the same way, whether you're, you know, it's the same thing, whether you're playing football or surfing or whatever, you're chasing this natural high, this thing that makes you feel good. You know, that's why you keep on scrolling through your Instagram and looking at your likes and stuff, because you're trying to, you know, your brain's reacting to it in a way. And
are you friends with those surfer girls that are here in your video? Because yeah. Julie Hernandez and Malia Ward.
Yeah, yeah. So they're friends of friends.
This guy. And,
yeah, man.
They're a music video with like the most gorgeous woman of surfing. Interested.
That's cool. Running around, hey, all these spaces, skateboarding, and you know, just I mean, even we rolled past Guitar Center. That's where past my mom to take me every Saturday. You know, the one on Sunset, and you know, every one of those spots in that video is like a memory, you know. So it was pretty personal, and I was like, you know what, nobody wants to look at me, you know, for the
I'll show them.
Well, I'm like, let's do something that's vibey, you know. Let's I was originally gonna do like roller skating and some booty shorts on girls, and I'm like, that's cool, that I'd like to look at that. And my wife was like, come on, you're better than this. And I'm like, am
not
I really
much better? I'm not much better.
I'm really not that much better, babe. And then we were like, you know, my daughter's skateboarding now, and she's surfing. And so I'm like, you know, there are a lot more girls skateboarding now and surfing out in the water than when I was growing up. And so I'm seeing, you know, that happen, that changeover. And I'm like, this is a cool thing. And I'm like, let's get people behind this. I'm like, let's just say more than the girl with the booty shorts. You know, I'm like, you got an opportunity here to do something, say something. I don't know if that's the dad in me. I don't know what that is. You know, I feel like, since I've become a dad, I've just been more punk rock about things in general. You care less about what people think. You just do your own thing. You got spit up walking into a store, you know, right here. You know, you're just like, fuck it, I don't care. You know, you just stop caring. And I'm sure your friends say the same thing, that have kids and stuff. They're just like, fuck it. And but yeah, man, I think the first time you're up on stage, that's probably the first time you feel like, whether it's to your junior high school dance, or you know, to a coffee shop full of people, or you know, standing in front of an amphitheater, you know, it's there's just a high off of it. And that's the time you feel that you're chasing, and that's the time you feel famous. You know, you're just like, man, this is worth it. I'm totally doing something good here. Yeah.
Is it aggravating? I'm sure both of you get it, but you know, Jack Johnson would listen in a little bit to your music. Is it aggravating when people are like, oh man, you sound like Jack Johnson, David? Or
dude, so let me fucking tell you this. So man, if I'm playing solo, and just based on the area that I live in and where I play solo or something like that, or if I'm anywhere really, people go, hey man, you sound like Jack Johnson. And I'm like, my voice sounds nothing like Jack Johnson. Like, you know, I got more country in my voice just by based of the, you know, tone of my voice than Jack and his thing. But I'm like, if that's who you're relating it to, I'm like, that's cool. Because you know what? That person means something to you probably. Yeah. And
you take the higher road.
Yeah, but it's cool. And you know what, I would love to go on tour with Jack. I'd love to just, you know, I mean, it would be, I'll go on. It's a compliment, because people don't, I say this, you know, people don't have to give you shit in this world. And when somebody gives you a compliment, or they tip you, or they give you something for free, you know, a guitar or whatever, they don't have to do a goddamn thing for you. And yeah. So when they do that, that means something.
Yeah.
And that, you know, so what is it? Somebody wrote out like had a blank sheet of like a legal pad, and they said, this is what you're entitled to in your fucking life. And there's nothing, you know, nothing. You're entitled to nothing, you know? And so, you know, unless you're born in the US, and then you get, you know, freedom of speech, and those are the things you're entitled to and such, but you know, which is a lot more than a lot of people have, but you know, yeah, I feel fortunate when somebody gives me a compliment and tells me that I sound like Jack, or tells me I sound like, you know, somebody I've never heard of before. Because, you know, sometimes I've never heard of that person before. I'll go check them out. You know, you get turned on by stuff and you're like, I don't really sound anything like them. But you know what? Something reminded them, felt good enough that they came up to me and said something. So, yeah.
You know, Brian, when you talk about keeping it real, I just was trying to think how to phrase it. So if you're writing your own music, though, if you're writing your own lyrics, wouldn't you always be keeping it real? I mean, the whole like sold out thing. How do you sell out when you're writing your own shit? You know, well, I don't know if you can.
I don't know if you can. I think that the big thing is like, it's just what people are a lot different as far as looking at things nowadays. Sometimes, like, I came from Texas. So like, I love everything about play, where I played in Texas and everything. But as soon as you jump in that vehicle and you move your way to Nashville, everybody automatically starts saying, hey, he's done sold out. But at the end of the day, like, you listen to my lyrics, you listen to my songs, you'll know that it's coming from the deepest places that I've ever been. And for my whole life, that's been in Texas and Louisiana and everywhere I've been and all the jobs I've done. And my babies, like I said, I worked in oil field 15 years. So when I was working out there on the rigs and I was missing my four babies, I wrote Oil Field Dad, and that song related to a lot of people in the oil field. And for 7 years, that song was one of my biggest songs I'd ever had. And everybody then thought I was famous. And they said, man, why are you still out here working on a rig? Why ain't you done moved to Nashville? Why ain't you done, you know, went and done this, that, and the other? And I, what you was talking about earlier about the American Idol thing, you'll never be able to count the amount of times in my post that people said, man, you ought to try out for The Voice. You ought to try out for American Idol. And that's always everybody says that. Everybody says it. And I think that that's their level that they put you on. I think they put you, you have to be on that level in order for them to see you as, you know, significant. And it's like with me moving up here, like I'm still friends with a lot of Cody Jinks's team, you know, Bobby Keith and his tour manager over there. And they're some of the realest people I've ever met. And that never got to his head. That never, none of that changed him. You know, he stayed who he was. And, you know, I know they're doing their own thing and it's taking off great. The same thing with a lot of these people I started out around, like Lainey Wilson and, you know, Priscilla Block. You know, we started out doing this stuff. And I never really saw myself as commercial, I'll be honest with you. Like, I really never see anything that I put out as commercial. But some way or another, some songs relate to people and he's in they. Hold on just a second.
Sure. Wish I had like the Jeopardy music. I'd be like,
I'm back. Yeah. But no, what I was saying, man, is I really truly believe that you can't sell out as long as you and your heart and soul know that you're being you. You're being you and you're being who you are. You're going to have haters in the comments that are going to say, you know, oh, well, he's sold out. But at the end of the day, like, you're not paying my rent either. You know, you know what I mean? It's like, you're not paying my rent. And if you listen to my lyrics, it comes from the realest places I've been. Like I said, I wear this every day because I saw my uncle get stabbed to death over drugs, you know.
Wow.
He was a Caddo Indian. And you know, it was my aunt that, you know, got put in jail for it. And she was an addict. And I come from a lot of deep, dark places. And overcoming those things through music has always been my way of moving forward. So whatever stair step and every time I moved past something, an addiction or whatever it was, I've always learned that there's growth in that. And that's not selling out. That's pretty much growing and learning from mistakes. And that's what you want your babies to do too, as they grow up. So you have to grow up with them, you know. Maybe a grown adult, but I had to do a whole lot of growing up as my kids were growing up.
Yeah. Do you drink or no?
I drink a little bit. I got real bad off on whiskey when me and my old lady had went through a year of separation. And that was the worst time of my life, I believe. But I wrote Beauty in the Struggle during that time. I wrote Lost during that time. Born to Shine, all in the meantime, staying in a camper trailer out behind my mom and daddy's house. And I couldn't see my kids but every couple weeks, and it was killing me. Like I said, I'd worked my whole life to see, you know, to take care of them and everything. And I'd been a pill addict for years. I was addicted to Oxycontin and everything else. When I first met her, I'd had a couple football injuries. I took that to extremes, and I just kind of followed down the road that the rest of my family was taking. And she stuck by me when I tried to quit two or three times during the time that we were together. And she was the only person that ever stood by me when I'd be curled up in the bed, coming home from work, curled up in the bed and shaking, just wishing I could just get one more fix, you know. And I always kept that with me. And that's why I wrote Beauty and the Struggle, is because when I was going through all that stuff, I realized real quick that I was not much of anything without that one, you know, and without her in my life and without my kids in my life. And the bottle started taking over, and like I said, I wrote Whiskey and the Devil and a couple other songs, and I learned real quick that, hey, I gotta get my priorities straight. You know, I've been through this once or twice in my life, and you can't speak, you know, stupid is a hard thing to fix. And, you know, what's that definition of insanity? Doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. Mm. And I had to really learn that the most important thing in my life is my music, my songs, and my babies and my family. Mm-hmm. So I went back to that. And that was after I had a real bad wreck in Kentucky. I went off a 20-foot cliff in Kentucky and had a brain injury. And they told me I wasn't ever going to be able to write songs again. They didn't think I would because I had such a bad brain injury. And it was like 2 weeks later, I wrote another song. And it was Self-Inflicted Scars. And that's the title of that album. It's just me telling myself that I can't blame none of this on nobody else. This is me. This is all self-inflicted scars. Everything I've been through has been self-inflicted. Nobody put that pill bottle in my hand. Nobody put that bottle of whiskey in my hand. I put it in my own hand. And it's my choice now what I do with that. You know, it's like I found some kind of peace in being able to, you know, go to a bar and not drink. Now, if I go to a bar and I say, hey, I want to have a beer, I found peace in knowing that I can have just one beer. But there was a time I couldn't do that. And like I said, that's the biggest thing with me is, you know, everybody in your life around you is what you, is what's fueling you. And this has been a big change in my life. Like moving up here and taking this chance, I'd always worked a regular job in the oil field and would save up just enough money to go record one song a year sometime because I wouldn't want to take food out of my baby's mouth to go cut music because I always thought that was kind of selfish of me. And then now taking this leap of faith and doing this full time, it really gets in your head because it's like, now I don't have a regular job to support this habit. this is my career. Like this is like on slow weeks, you're like, what am I going to do? Because now I don't have a backup plan, you know? And the only thing to do is enjoy the climb and find wisdom in the valleys because you got to have both of them. You got to have both of them, man.
Mm-hmm. That's great. It's good advice.
Thank you, brother.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate both you guys' time. Thank you for it.
Thank you, man.
I look forward to talking to you guys both again soon on the next album. We'll bring it back. Thanks for watching. Don't forget to like and subscribe by clicking the round button on the bottom right. To learn more about me or the guests on the show, go to joelrody.com. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, or TikTok. The handle's Joel Rody. And don't forget, when you party like a rock star, don't be a dick.